Hello. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Citizen Radio. I am Jamie Kilstein, and joining me as always is Matt Christman and Felix Biederman. How are you guys doing?
This new song I wrote, it's called Fuck the NRA. It comes from a very personal place.
I'm going to not be very good today. I really reckoned with my privilege this morning, and it's left me in a place that's really dark.
I've been up since 5, eating pineapple and doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu, so I'm ready to go. No, this is not Citizen Radio. This is the first episode of a new podcast that we hope to be bringing you every week. It's sort of a conversation, a free-flowing sort of live wire look where we take a sort of sideways glance at the week's news and popular culture. And with me, as I mentioned already, are Felix Biederman at By Your Logic on Twitter and Matt Christman at Kushbaum on Twitter. I am Will Meneker. And you perhaps know us from our appearances on the Street Fight podcast. Most recently, we did an episode about Michael Bay's 13 Hours and the phenomenon that is Benghazi in popular culture. And we received such an amazing response from the people, from our public, that through overwhelming demand, we decided to branch out and do one of our own. So that's what we're doing now.
This is basically like After MASH. It's the world's greatest spinoff.
Another thing to compare it to is I know that there's a big crossover between our fans and Chris Hardwick's. So think of this like Talking Bad or Battleship Gotactica, any number one of Chris Hardwick projects where he talks about a show that was just on.
And
only
like
the
that-
show. Yes, our show is the world.
Our show is like the ongoing, breakdown and degeneracy of politics and culture in America.
It's basically like if Chris Hardwick had been around in early 30s Germany.
But like Chris Hardwick, we hope to have, a rotating cast of guests and co-hosts and interviewees that we hope to bring you. But we're just starting off right now. It's very rough. So we're going to start with this original triumvirate who sprung out of the head of Street Fight like Zeus to become the new gods of Egypt.
This podcast, by the way, brought to you by the film Gods of Egypt.
Starring Gerard Butler in theaters everywhere.
And also available on demand.
Now, yeah. Kick things off. Maybe we could just talk very briefly about who we are. I am Will Meneker. You know me as Will Meneker from Twitter. But just tell you a little about myself. I love coffee, dogs, big-time movie guy, and I'm really into neo-feudalism and amateur phrenology. Blood, soil, and tradition.
My name is Felix Biederman, at By Your Logic, Vernuth, Keurig, not Tassimo. If you're Tassimo, unfollow. Faves are pejorative. Lists are to keep track of my favorites. Retweets are not endorsement, and my son is dead.
My name's Matt Christman, at Kushbaum. I'm sort of the Midwest correspondent to talk to sort of the rootless cosmopolitan New Yorkers on the team. And the only thing I love but more than a hot sizzling plate of bacon is proving people wrong by their own...
their own logic? Did we lose Matt?
Matt was chiving too hard and his broadband went out.
All right, we're just going to have to keep going.
Matt, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Did you get
anything? Oh, we lost you for a second. We lost you for a second. You were about to share your interest in race science and neo-feudalism?
Well, of course. I mean, those are the sort of the two to the two parts of my holy trinity of belief. The other one, of course, being memes.
Yeah, I mean, I guess like we should warn you right now. You know, if you don't like seeing sacred cows be slaughtered, or if you don't like listening to, you know, logical arguments, then you should probably switch off now.
You know, it's like the Joker said, the scariest costume that I ever made society wear was a mirror.
We're like the Joker and Deadpool came together and made a crazy, no-holds-barred podcast.
Wearing Heisenberg's hat.
Someone get on Photoshop right now and create that image so we can use it as a banner for this.
Yeah, if you're a fan of prisoners being taken, you might want to look elsewhere.
No prisoners will be taken on this podcast. It's only the truth and only reason and logic 100% of the time.
If you tweet at us at any of our handles, if you write emails to the show, if you call into the show, and you are employing the milkman fallacy, the fat governor fallacy, any of them, we will not hesitate to call you on it.
There's nothing I like better than just reducing simpletons and libtards to just like a quivering pile of their own urine and soiled garments when I just slay them with logic.
I've always said my entire life that I considered a sign of victory when my opponents resort to ad hominem attacks.
The road to hell is paved with people who proved my point for me.
And really, I mean, we've done this so often now on Twitter that it really can't be contained in one platform anymore.
Yeah, I mean, and I like to go around during the day and just shred people with logic who I meet just on the streets, you know?
The other day, I was in a movie theater. I was seeing a second run of Deadpool. I'd already seen the first one, and I noticed that an inner-city youth with sagging pants, he wasn't pulling his pants up, was talking loudly during the film. I couldn't hear when Deadpool called the villain of the movie a fuck cunt shit waffle dick whistle before unleashing his katana attack. This is my favorite part of the movie, and I stood up and I said, "Excuse me, sir, my good sir, if you have your way, movies will no longer be a spectator sport, but an audience participation event. And judging by Facebook, that's not a good thing." And the entire theater clapped.
I love it. I love that superhero movies can finally be R-rated, because, you know, someone who's a 30-plus-year-old man like me has been waiting a long time to have a superhero movie that I could really get behind. That's at my level. And you need the R rating for it to get there.
You know, I think that Dark Batman, the Dark Batman series that we all love, by Christopher Nolan, it was great, and it, you know, it showed us things that we didn't even know lived inside of us. But I wish it had that R rating.
I just needed him to say fuck, and I needed to see headshots. I needed to see people's heads getting snapped back by bullet hits.
I need to see that pink mist coming out of the back of the skull.
Is the will the Zack Snyder Batman vs. Superman movie have pink mist in it? Will it be R-rated?
I don't know, actually.
Apparently they're going to do an R-rated cut for the DVD.
Oh, so I have to wait that long to see the true director's vision?
I know, it's bullcrap. I mean, I want to see... I want to see Batman's hog in an IMAX screen, not at my house. I mean, yes, my TV is 75 inches. It's massive, but it's no IMAX, and that's where I want to see the bulge.
I know what you mean. There's nothing I like better than kicking back with a Blu-ray special edition of the film adaptation of SWAT, starring LL Cool J and Jeremy Renner. But... it's just something about the theater experience can't really be replicated at home, especially when the wife is nagging you.
Yeah, we can't all be John Nolte in Greedy Part. We can't all be kids going to the theater. Get yourselves a big thing of popcorn, and write reviews of it for Breitbart about how Batman is a conservative. I heard there's a very explosive scene in the Batman vs. Superman R-rated cut where Batman, in order to save the world, he has to say the N-word.
That's a big dilemma for sure. I mean, in the first Zack Snyder Superman, people were very angry that Superman kills someone at the end of the movie because they said in the comics he never killed someone. But if he didn't kill someone, if he didn't kill the bad guy, he would have killed all of Metropolis. So, in a way, he was right. So if he doesn't say the N-word and Brainiac takes over the entire planet, I mean, who's to say? I mean, that he's wrong.
Exactly. In a situation like that, you really have to ask, who's the real racist? Yeah. The guy who says the N-word or the guy who says that he can't, even though it's going to make the world explode?
What if the N-word is like the password that will stop Lex Luthor's doomsday machine from going off, but you have to say it to turn it off? Is it okay to say then?
I think the movie is going to be an allegory for the situation we find ourselves in, where if we were all allowed to say it, we would be able to create racial harmony. And it's the fact that we're not allowed to by the PC police that makes all of this racism and strife continue.
This is why we're so divided as a country, really, because people keep talking about racism.
Yeah, and some people get to say the N-word and other people don't, and that's privilege. That's essentially segregation, if you think about it.
Is it fair? You know, the people are always talking about what's fair and what's not fair. But to me, to tell an entire group of people that there's, you know, a magic word that we can't say,
it's
not fair to me.
It's almost as though we have like one drinking fountain for people who get to say the N-word and one for people who don't.
Wow.
Just, you know, just a little thing for you guys chew on. Eminem sold 50 million records, and he didn't say that word once.
Think how many he could have sold if he could have said it.
Exactly. He'd be president right now if he'd been able to do that.
Eminem is single-handedly responsible for ending the Bush presidency.
Oh, actually, yeah, I was going to bring that up. Do you remember when he did that song for John Kerry? This is sort of like...
March. I think it was called March.
Yeah, it's called March, yeah, in 2004.
No, yeah, it came out like 2 weeks before the election. For Maximum Impact.
That was like Fortunate Son for our generation.
It was better than Fortunate Son.
We should maybe make March the sort of like the bump music for the podcast if I ever figure out how to edit songs into this.
I want that, and I want Mosh, like his big anti-Bush song. The Tito Ortiz, the former UFC light heavyweight champion, used to walk out to Mosh, and now he's a Trump supporter.
Makes you think.
Yeah, it does.
So I maybe as just a segue from the 2004 election into the one that's currently going on, this obviously this is what's consuming all of our thoughts is this election. And I think this past week in the election is genuinely fascinating, and I think there are a lot of interesting things to unpack. Bernie won Michigan on Tuesday, right?
Yes, he did. Surprising even Carl Digler, who has called a lot of upsets.
Usually Digler is never wrong, but even the Dig didn't see that coming.
Yeah,
and to be fair, I don't think Bernie even saw it coming either. When he gave that press conference in front of those high school bleachers, it seemed like he was not expecting to win.
No, he wasn't. And at only one point, I was watching the entire thing, at only one point did Hillary lead him, I think.
What, in the vote count?
Yeah.
Yeah, he had a lead the whole night, and I kept waiting for it to go away, and it fluctuated, but it never really did.
Yeah, she closed it up a few times. She got within, like, 1.5 points, but, like, she never made it. Even... like, what the Clinton people were saying the entire night, like, wait for all the Wayne County votes to come in. And it was never enough.
So, I mean, that was, you know, a fairly stunning upset. I mean, again, nobody saw that coming. And I think it's really, I mean, genuinely, I'm not being facetious here, I think has really kind of upset a lot of what I thought was going to happen in this election. Like, so there's a lot of Midwestern states to come next week, right, on the 15th? There's like Ohio and Illinois next week, am I right?
Yeah, yeah, coming up.
Now, I mean, do you guys think that, that coming out of Michigan, like there's a good chance that Bernie could pick up one or two of those? Because I do.
I think he has a great chance in Illinois.
Okay,
especially since he came out and told Rahm Emanuel to suck it.
Right. He's got he's going straight at Rahm Emanuel. And then last night, the sort of capstone to this week, this big Trump event in Chicago was canceled because of all of these protests. And most of the people, or a lot of the people actually in the arena were chanting Bernie, right? They weren't chanting Hillary, they were chanting Bernie, and they were the seemed to be the ones where the real energy was in terms of actually shutting down this Trump event, right?
Well, what could you expect? What else to expect from a bunch of mansplainers like Bernie supporters?
Yeah, no, it shouldn't shock anyone that they harassed someone and silenced them, because I mean this is what they do all the time.
Also, to be fair, Hillary men did soften up Trump for Bernie supporters, like they did. They rattled him with body blows like my hashtag daughter is not a fan of Donald Trump. And that shook him, that scared him, and it, you know, it made him vulnerable enough for the white male harassers that we saw in Chicago make him run away.
It's sort of like if you have a pickle jar and you're like, you know, sweating, you're just really trying to get that cap off, and then you hand it off to someone else and they pop it off like on the first take. You know why, right? I mean, they did that because you got it started. It only seemed easy to them because you did most of the real hard work.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, they really should be thanking Tom Watson and Peter Dow.
Now, the other thing that happened this week was a couple really coming out of Michigan. I think the desperation among the Hillary people is becoming palpable because they clearly thought they were going to win it. They clearly thought there was no way after Super Tuesday, the first one, that Sanders is really going to get any traction anymore. They thought it was smooth sailing. Sanders comes in and wins Michigan, and I think, like I said, I think their desperation is driving them to very strange places. The first of which occurred when Hillary or her supporter, did Hillary ever say this, or was it more her supporters, that started attacking Sanders over his support for the Sandinistas in Nicaragua in the 80s, and also linking him to Fidel Castro?
Yeah, Amanda Marcotte, yeah.
Well, yeah, but that was because of the Univision debate.
Okay, the Univision debate, he was asked about his support for the Sandinistas in the 80s, and also, like, kind things that he said about the Castros.
Yeah, and then Marcotte and everyone decided to just riff on that about how disqualifying it was that he was, you know, on the side of the people who were, not being attacked by a bunch of rapist terrorists.
And that was the weirdest thing. I mean, about Marcotte in particular's line about this is that when people confronted her with it, they were like, "What are you talking about?" Like, she said, "It puts the lie to his supposed belief in non-interventionism."
Which yes, because is, he
like,
wanted
supporting
to,
well, the Sandinistas was the non-interventionist platform.
I wanted to prop up the Sandinistas by saying we should stop arming a bunch of psychotic.
Yeah, like the CIA was intervening in Nicaragua by funding an army of like terrorist death squads. Basically, that was the intervention, and anyone who's read a fucking book knows that.
I mean, right. Will, you said, I remember like a few days, you said, what's the most reactionary position that Hillary supporters are going to take to defend Hillary before this primary is over? And hopefully this is it. Hopefully defending guys who fucking light nuns on fire and rape peasants will be it. But I don't think it will be.
To be fair, I don't think they were, again, like it was. They had a sort of plausible deniability about saying, well, of course the Contras were bad, but, you know, it's more complicated than that. It's naive of him. So basically creating a kind of false equivalence to say that, well, both sides are really bad. But to answer your question, I did pose that question at the beginning of the week. What is the most reactionary position that Hillary supporters will defend before the primary is over? And by the end of the week, I think I got my answer in Reagan's AIDS policies.
Yeah, it's been a hell of a week in Hillary land.
He started a conversation.
You know,
God bless him for it.
You know, I always say that Mullah Omar, he started a conversation about the eyesore Buddhist statues.
But the thing about that was so interesting about that is because, you know, she said, well, they started this national conversation. And that, of course, is resilient, ridiculous. But what's kind of revealing for me about her current policy is, you know, their big attack on Bernie is, you know, he's too focused on class and he's not doing enough about racism and sexism. But, of course, she doesn't have any kind of specific policies that she can point to that are in some way more, you know, more cogently pointed towards those issues. What she has is this thing about how we need to have a national conversation about racism, right? How we need to be talking about and acknowledging our privilege and all this rhetorical stance stuff. And if, you know, if the model for that is Ronald and Nancy Reagan starting a conversation on AIDS, I think that might be a bit of a bummer of a national conversation.
Yeah, I'll say. Jesus. Yeah, I mean, like, it seems like she keeps, you know, I'm not going to use a gendered insult here, so I'm just going to say she keeps tripping over her own dick with these statements. And, like, and the Nicaragua, the Contras thing, I don't think is, like, a big deal because I don't think most people know or care about that. But the Nancy Reagan thing, I think, really hurt her in a way. And she did, she apologized for it almost immediately because I think, like, for a lot of the people who, like, are big time Democratic Party boosters. I think like that's a line that they just absolutely cannot have her cross. Because a lot of people remember that. A lot of people remember that about the 80s and how awful the Reagans were about
that thing was the closest we've seen in this campaign of the I'm trying to remove it drill tweet. She's just like immediately like sorry, I'm trying to remove it. With one of the most amazing excuses I've ever heard, which is that she apparently was thinking of their work on Alzheimer's.
Oh, man.
She said, I was thinking about the work they did with Alzheimer's, and it just, you know, between my head and my mouth, it turned into AIDS.
I could see how one can make that mistake.
Totally. They're very similar situations.
Does anyone fucking melt down like Hillary? I've never seen a national politician. I mean, the only guy close is probably Marco Rubio. No one falls apart quite like Hillary does. She loses Iowa 8 years ago. What is her silver bullet? I'm going to send Bill Clinton to South Carolina to say racist stuff.
She is perpetually shook, which is this idea, which is what makes it so hilarious, this idea that she is going to be the one to stand up to Donald Trump in a general election.
I mean, I don't know. I think she could probably do a pretty good job against Donald. I mean, probably more than any of the Republicans have done so far. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, there's this whole growing theory that he would win against her, and I still don't think that's true.
Yeah, I don't buy that. I don't buy that.
But I do think that just from an aesthetic sort of, you know, it would be so radically asymmetrical an election that it would almost make you want to barf because you'd have Trump out there whipping this, you know, horrible lizard-brained racist, you know, core supporters to a frenzy, and then on the other side it's like, hey everybody, who wants means testing? that's not a balance. It's like you really need to have some sort of sense that there's a genuine battle going on, you know, for the soul of America, as opposed to, you know, this sort of bloodless status quo and this slathering right-wing insurgency.
I mean, if you look at history, who does better against nativist demagogic movements than uninspired right-wing centrists?
Because, yes, she will win. I don't think there's any question about that. But the thing I think about is, give it 4 years, you know? 4 years of a Hillary presidency, you know, let the Chinese economy fall apart a little bit, which it looks like it might be doing. get a nicely timed recession. And then what kind of gargoyle will take the ball from Trump, shine it up a little bit, and then go bring it across the finish line? It's like, it's frankly terrifying to even think about.
No, it's really dark. And let me ask you guys this. Do you think that what we're seeing right now in this election, and you know, the pessimist in me sort of knows at some point that it's going to revert to type. I don't know when, maybe at the conventions. I mean, like, look, I'm much more optimistic about Bernie actually winning this thing than I was like a couple weeks ago. I think he can do it, but it's a slim chance, right? I still kind of don't think the Republicans are going to let Trump take the nomination.
I think Kasich is going to win Ohio. He put out a very rambling video where Urban Meyer, the coach of OSU, and him just mumble to each other and stare at each other for 90 seconds. It's just fucking, what a bizarre man John Kasich is. But he's going to win there, and you know, little Marco.
I live in Ohio, and I can tell you that Kasich is definitely, he has totally nailed down the vital demographic of dudes who loiter in hardware stores.
That's it. That's fucking Kasich country. That's the guys who aren't doing anything illegal. And yeah, no, that's going to, we're probably going to have a brokered convention. And hopefully me and Virgil, Texas, will be able to go to the convention.
I will. I swear on Jupiter's hammer that I will be there. It's like a 4-hour drive for me, and it's going to happen. I'm going to spend the week up there. Oh, no matter what happens, it's going to be amazing. But I actually think that Trump, because yes, Kasich will win. Kasich will win Ohio, I think. But
Trump's definitely going to win Florida, though, right?
Trump will win Florida, and that kills Rubio, which at this point, who cares, you know. But moving on, you've got big delegate-rich states that are winner-take-all. And, like, even in a three-way race, I don't see Trump losing, like, California or New York. So I think he still has a chance to really – to go with the
– to get enough delegates to be impossible
to be a first-ballot winner, unless – they try to actually stop him at the
unless they
by
try
challenging
to actually,
the delegates.
Unless they try to actually assassinate him, which, you know.
Oh, God, they would.
Believe me, I think there's some people are thinking about.
Brad Thor, we hear you're dead on the spot.
Oh, man.
Yeah, Brad Thor needs to write a book about, like, you know, Special Agent Colt slang bang thwarting an assassination attempt on Trump right before he signs the, you know, ban gay immigrants.
No. Brad Thor is very anti-Trump. The hero of a Brad Thor novel would be the guy who puts him down.
See, I don't know that because he blocked me like 3 years ago, so I don't know.
Oh, no, I follow him. He's an extraordinary idiot. He said something last night along the lines of, he's like, what you're seeing in Chicago is just a dress rehearsal for what the left is going to do in the general election. We can't let their op campaign work. We can't let their optics campaign work. And, like, he's just one of these guys who's, like, you know, mind has been rotted by, like, all this mill-speak. Like, he thinks that, like, normal people relate to this. Or, like, I mean, I don't know who's impressed by it or what, but, like, he just peppers his dial, you know, his regular talk with this kind of, like, weird op-speak.
I actually met him once when I worked at
a... He's got the grass.
I actually met him once. I was working at a Barnes & Noble, and he came in to sign some books. He didn't have it wasn't like a thing. He was just in town, and so they just brought him his books to the counter, and he just signed them all and then left. But he just looked like kind of a angry golf dad, and a short one, I should point that out. He's like 5'8".
I remember he was on CNN a while ago, and again, they brought him on because he uses – phrases like optics campaign and people think he's some kind of, you know, expert on counterinsurgency. And he came on to talk about, I don't know, Iraq or Afghanistan or something. And he was talking about RPGs, the rocket propelled grenades that, you know, can take out a tank or Humvee or something like that. And he wanted to say they were like a flying improvised explosive device, but he ended up saying on air, these RPGs are really like a flying IUD.
See, that's what happens when you try to get that kind of expertise from a thriller writer who does not have 500 different naval caps like Tom Clancy did. Because would go out there with his Nimitz hat, I knew that guy knew what he was talking about. Doesn't have a hat. Get out of here.
I've never seen Brad Thor wearing one of those like USS Enterprise hats and like armor jackets. Never.
Get him out of here. He's disgusting.
Salmon-colored shirt and some kind of blazer.
But you're talking about, like, jokingly about the GOP establishment assassinating him. There is, on the alt-right today, a theory going around that last night was a thwarted assassination attempt on Trump.
Oh, yeah. I saw that.
and that it was coordinated between MoveOn, because that's the big argument now, is that the whole thing was set up by MoveOn, and then the leading Republican candidates. Like, they all knew it was going to happen. And they were all going to, like, give a speech afterwards, you know, saying how horrified they were. But, yes, the theory was that they were going to rush the stage, murder Trump, and then, I guess, I don't know, at that point, what they would do. They would draw straws to see which one got to be the nominee.
All right, John Huntsman is now the nominee.
What I love about this assassination op is that it requires Trump's going to come on stage, and then like a stadium full of people are all just going to rush the stage at once and like rip him to shreds. And it's like stadiums and concerts and things like that are sort of set up so that kind of thing just can't happen. Like, I mean, like,
no, there's a huge dead space.
Yeah,
the closest seats and the stage. It's like these idiots have never been to a venue in their lives.
Well, the Africans fast twitch muscles.
See, they could just jump over those barricades in a single bound because of the extra muscle in their calves.
Like, yeah, that's what Jesse Owens was going to do to Hitler at the 36 Olympics.
But then Damon Linker's great-grandfather convinced him that that wasn't the right way.
Yeah,
he made a scathing op-ed about it first.
Damon Linkenbeck wrote just excoriated Hitler and said, "Buddy, beer halls are no place to do this type of thing."
Beer halls are for having fun.
He said, "We need to look to the Molotov-Ribbentrop Treaty, and that's the future right there."
Hey, Hitler.
Differences.
Hitler, Kristallnacht? Not a good look.
Rethink this, Hitler. Hitler, we love you. Please empathize with us.
No, the problem is when you have, you know, two extremes on the left and right, it's just the extremes feed each other and just create this cycle of violence, which is what we saw in the Battle of Stalingrad.
Absolutely true.
It was just two extremes, you know. I mean, both sides were bad, is what I'm trying to say.
As is always the case. You need the comforting centrist wisdom of a guy who pleats his pubic hair to tell you you need what because people are going to, you know, people who are scared and whose lives are radically destabilized by the you know, titanic forces of capitalism that are completely outside of their control and sight, but at the same time totally determine the course of their lives. I mean, these people just need just some guidance, and they need a few op-eds, and they need to just stop and think about, you know, what do their kids think when they see them out there protesting and asserting, you know, democratic ideals?
What would their kids think of all the cussing?
You know, I know what my son thinks, and he says, "What country am I in, Dad?"
my boy Cody, he was looking at these horrible scenes from Chicago last night of just, you know, anarchy in our streets, and he said, Daddy, who will reform Social Security so that I will have it when I'm your age?" And I said, "Son, I don't know. I just don't know."
My daughter is 3 years old. She
your hashtag daughter.
Hashtag daughter is 3 years old. She's made Hillary "I'm with her" signs in Minecraft, just like a really precocious youth. She turned to me after the protest and said, "Dad, I see why you wrote all those columns about Trump. And I also see, after Chicago, why you pay my long-haired cousin to edit Elvis Presley songs to make him sound less black, to make him less scary.
Okay, so returning back, so like, I think, okay, I genuinely don't know what's going to happen. The Republicans are in an absolutely, they're in a, like a Mexican standoff with themselves. And it's like an end of Reservoir Dogs, basically, is like what's going on in the Republican Party right now. And everyone's going to end up getting shot, which is glorious. But I guess what I'm interested in is, like, are we seeing right now in this election the beginnings of the breakup of the two-party system in this country? I mean, that's what I'm hoping for, but I mean, I don't know if that's,
well,
you know,
the issue, the problem with that, and you certainly have the forces at play that logically should lead to that happening when you see, you know, just the radical fracture between both parties' base, and their elites. The problem is that the U.S. political structure is so channeled and path dependent towards two parties that how it would happen would be, I don't know. That's the issue, is how would something like that happen when every structural element of the American political system pushes you towards two parties. And like other times that the national party dissolved, you know, like the Whigs, it was along sectional lines or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's never really been about ideological lines. What usually happens with there's some sort of breach between a party's base or a section of a party's base and their elites is that they go to the other side. Like that's what happened with the Southern Democrats after the Civil Rights Act. They went to the Republicans. But, like, there really is nowhere to go now, you know? So that's no longer an option. So I don't know. Like,
okay, so, like, but going into this... Going into this convention, right, the Republican convention, either Trump will be the nominee, and then you'll have people like David Frum strongly urging someone to organize some kind of, like, third-party, true conservative, like, sort of protest candidacy to kind of wash their hands, like, sort of symbolically wash the hands of the conservative movement of the stink of Trump, who they regard as, you know, an imposter, or they will broker him out of the convention and create, you know, this huge swath of intensely angry and betrayed feeling people who would otherwise vote Republican, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's always a chance. I mean, like, would Trump run as an independent in that case?
Well, the thing is, he wouldn't be able to. That'd be too late to get on the ballot.
Okay,
he would have to do something that has never happened before. It wouldn't be impossible, certainly given his name recognition. I mean, he wouldn't even need to spend a dime. He could just go on TV after the convention and say, "Write me in."
Okay.
And it would have to be a national write-in campaign.
Oh, I see.
Now that's not. That's literally unprecedented. That's never happened before. So I have no idea what that would do. But that would be his only third-party recourse if he waited until the convention. You know, and he goes to the convention assuming, as he should, that, oh, having enough delegates should be enough to give it to me. At that point, his only recourse would be a write-in campaign.
And then, I guess on the other side, I mean, it's harder to see, you know, the how a fracture in the Democratic Party would end up, I don't know, in any kind of permanent way, but, you know, the Bernie-Hillary divide is, I think, a profound and deeply instructive one that I can't see it going away in the future, although, I don't know, I'm sure it'll just get sort of subsumed back into the, you know, Democratic Party as it always does. I mean, I don't know, it's hard to say, but... I mean, how do you guys? Where do you guys see that going?
I think the generational divide is too big. I think if it was Bernie up against any other, I mean, who else is there that they could have put up there? But anyone else but Hillary?
Joe Biden.
Joe Biden, I guess. Like a boss, but someone who didn't fucking melt down and pivot right in the most clumsy way possible and fuck up and piss people off constantly, didn't have 25 years of awful baggage and just insanity and paranoia like the Clintons.
Whose instincts in every sense are to shit on the left.
Awful.
Like, it's like a bodily instinct to them. It's amazing.
Yeah, if it was someone different than that, and someone with, like, surrogates who just don't actively cause people to fucking hate them, but maybe surrogates who don't have histories in death squads. I'm like, yeah, no, this is going to get absorbed back in the Democratic Party, but now I'm not so sure. Like, the fact that Bernie just explicitly told Rahm Emanuel to suck his cock and called him, like, a shitty mayor and all this stuff, it's... people, yeah, you can only sell shit to people that doesn't turn out for so long before they turn on you.
Problem for them, though, is that there's really no bench beyond Bernie, you know? Like, there isn't a core...
Yeah.
There isn't a core of, like, elected officials and high-profile people who they could kind of rally around.
Who's the next Bernie? Like, I can't think of anyone. And the thing is, he never really was a Democrat. He was, like, the only one who was an independent for his entire career, and even in the Senate, he was an independent who voted with the Democrats. Like, I can't think of who the next one is, and it's almost like it seemed totally improbable, like it's a complete fluke that he's even gotten this far. I mean, looking back on it now, it seems like it's hard to believe that he couldn't have done this, because there's such a huge amount of space and energy behind his campaign right now, but it seemed completely unlikely when it first started.
The danger, though, I think I'm not terribly optimistic, frankly, about what's going to happen with the Democrats, because, I mean, I remember seeing a month ago, an article about Democratic members of Congress marveling at the Burby phenomenon and wondering, how can we get that money that he's getting with those small donations? That looks really great. What can we do? What can we do to kind of funding source from all of those small donors? Now, if they actually had any kind of, principles, they wouldn't have to ask that question. They would say, oh, if I have this sort of principled stand for these ideals, people will be willing to fund my campaign. The fact that their instinct is, how could I do that, means they've already discounted that as a possibility. Like, having principle, no, that's not going to be it. What other thing can I do that approximates that enough for these rubes to send me $20 checks?
These guys saw Mandela, and they're like, God, how can we get Bono to sing for Democrats?
No, I mean, I largely agree. I think Bernie has done an amazing and admirable thing running as basically the most probably left candidate for president since, I don't know, FDR? Maybe
I'd say McGovern.
Yeah, McGovern. Yeah, perhaps. But I don't think there's any saving the Democratic Party. I don't think he can fix the Democratic Party. I mean, just because, like, structurally, like how it exists and why it exists, it makes it impossible for something like the kind of, sort of broadly speaking, like social democratic policies that he stands for, ever really taking root there. I don't think it can be fixed. And I think what they're going to do in response to this is more of, again, what we've seen from Hillary, which is this kind of, like, you know, I'm your abuela, and, like, you know, intersectionality, and kind of, like, hitting these notes about sort of, like this micro-tailoring to, like, every conceivable sort of identity and group constituency, and, like, sort of these symbolic expressions of respect and affirmation of those people and groups.
I did notice that Hillary, on her Twitter feed the other day, she made a tweet and then replied to the tweet and said, if you're an NBPOC and you're retweeting this, stop. It's not for you.
And very little in this world is.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's another thing I wanted to bring up. This is also at the beginning of the week or last week. Comedians weighing in on the election, and specifically what Louis C.K. said, who obliterated Donald Trump in a scathing rant online in which he encouraged people to vote for John Kasich instead.
Can I talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, please do.
I think I know why he supports John Kasich. As someone who's seen John Kasich speak live, John Kasich, one of the many times we saw him at a town hall in New Hampshire, he told this fucking weird story where he goes, when I was a boy, there was a pony ride in my neighborhood. My mom paid the man who owned the horse too much for the pony, and I said, why'd you do that? And she said, well, John, some people aren't as lucky as us. And I looked at the boy whose dad owned the pony, and he had a swollen eye. And later I saw the man who owned the pony on the train, and it turns out he was our mailman.
So his story is that he found out his mailman abuses his kids.
I don't even think it was clear if he abused his kid. Maybe he had, I don't know what it was.
Maybe the pony kicked the kid.
But like that John Kasich thing is like an episode of the latest season of Louis. Brutal moral thread in there, surrounded by just unclear plot and scenes that don't need to be there. And Louis probably saw that speech and was like, "This is genius. I'm gonna shit my daughter's cunt."
But when I saw them,
my daughters are idiots. They're stupid. I have to look at their vaginas, even though I'm their dad. But it's their country now. Think of them. Trump's a Nazi.
When I saw the response to that, like I literally saw somebody go, you know, Louis could probably be a better candidate than anybody running. And between that and the John Oliver thing, you know, the way that people are like, John Oliver, we need another evisceration. What are you doing? Is that it made me finally realize that for liberals, for sicko libs of the internet variety, comedians, specifically like those kind of quasi-political comedians, are the equivalent of what the troops are to conservatives.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, for that, like, they're this sort of mythical caste who, like, defend our freedom and sort of embody the best of us. And those are, for conservatives, the martial virtues of the military. And for the internet lib, it's just, you know, being funny, being snarky, you know.
Speaking truth to power.
Yeah. Eviscerating people. Like, it's both in both cases, it's a fantasy of power, but it's just so sad because it doesn't reflect well on the liberals when, you know, the conservative fantasy of power is like you light up 5 Hajis and then, you know, blow up somebody's hut with an RPG. But their fantasy is, oh man, he totally said that thing to that guy's face. He feels so stupid now.
And
it's
like
it's their fantasy. You know, the conservative fantasy is like Full Metal Jacket or something. You know, the door gunner machine gunning fleeing peasants. But for the liberal, it's Stephen Colbert at that Bush White House Correspondents' Dinner.
You know, I liked Colbert at that Correspondents' Dinner because I thought he was fairly mean to the people who were right in front of him. But, you know, there was Salon.com had an article this week that was like, Jon Stewart retired too early. Like, yeah. John, come back. We need you or whatever. Yeah. And, you know, the thing about The Daily Show, and, you know, I like probably – most people, my age, you know, was a big fan of The Daily Show during the Bush years. And then during the Obama years, I think it sort of, it was the rally to restore sanity that really kind of like turned me on The Daily Show.
What a disgrace.
It was disgraceful. It was disgraceful, and it really revealed the limits of that kind of comedy. And even like, and looking back on it, like Jon Stewart, you know, He was funny and he was very good at a lot of the things he did, but his major weakness was always as an interviewer, and he was always wanted to be liked by the people he was interviewing. So like if he was doing The Daily Show now, like Donald Trump would come on the show and like completely own him, and Stewart would like for it.
And it was kind of gross though because he would occasionally eviscerate somebody, but it was always some chump.
Jim Cramer. It was Jim Cramer and Chris Matthews.
No status, or it was like some random backbench Republican congressman who said something dumb, you know. But if it was somebody who he wanted to have back on the show, he would take the edge off of every question. But, I mean, I was a big fan of The Daily Show, obviously, during the Bush administration. But, I mean, thinking back on it now, I kind of, especially the way he's been turned into this idol, I really kind of questioned the entire political comedy Daily Show mindset that got spawned and is now embodied by John Oliver. Because, like, when you read people say what they like about it, what they liked about the show and what they like about Oliver, one word keeps coming up, and it's catharsis. And in catharsis is bad.
Yeah.
Catharsis is what dissipates energy. Catharsis is like is a therapeutic loosening of energy and divert and dissipate. You know, I was mad, but then I watched The Daily Show, and now I feel a little better. That's bad.
It's like
bad for political engagement.
Yeah, it's like the soma pill. You know, it's like it was the kind of the opiate of the masses for this kind of like
it was the opiate for a certain type
sort of liberal class of people.
Yeah. Catharsis is a luxury that you only get when you go to your fucking graphic design job or your Vox job and you fucking jack off the spreadsheets all day and I'm so mad about these Republicans, and then you get home and then you're like, oh, I'm not so mad anymore. Well, someone made them look ridiculous. That's not a luxury.
I have health insurance.
Fucking
so it doesn't
anyone
really...
else in the world has.
Yeah. I have health insurance. It doesn't really matter. Yeah.
And, you know, and to a certain degree, I think that's why, you know, to use the cliche, both sides are having such a hard time metabolizing exactly what we saw in Chicago just last night, where, you know, basically what were, you know, activist young people by the thousands, you know, turned up and sort of like turned out, like, and sort of physically confronted many of, you know, Trump's more, I don't know, degenerate supporters, and basically for the first time actually shut him up, literally. Shut him up and made him look like a fool, you know, in front of on a national stage. And they didn't do it because they were being, like, you know, snarky. They didn't call him Donald Trump, is what I'm trying to say.
You see how worthless the liberal commentariat is, because they're afraid by this. They think that these fucking morons are actually saying that they violated Donald Trump's free speech.
Oh, I know. How will he get his message out now if he can't?
But, like, that's the world that these people live in. Like, that they're, despite all their liberalism, no matter how many times they retweet D-Ray, no matter how many fucking times that they think that grilling isn't feminist enough, they're these fucking fat, coastal, rich fucks who live in fear of, like, a rowdy urban teen yelling at them at a movie theater. So when they see someone who is one of their own, like a coastal elite like Donald Trump, pussy the fuck out like they have their entire lives. They're like, oh, I recognize that. That's a real problem. I know what the real problem here is.
Or it's just like, it's just this attitude of, like, we've been told now, you know, for months and months by sort of both sides of the sort of media and political elite on the left and right in this country, that Donald Trump is a dangerous, like, genuinely disturbing actual fascist who is, like, whipping up, you know, a level of hysteria in this country that has, like, you know, really dark and violent potential. And then, like, their utter inability to deal with this by, you know, publishing special editions of their magazine or mocking him on late night cable TV has proven totally inadequate and, in fact, has probably only helped Trump. And then again, like, when they're finally confronted with people who did actually stop him and did stand up to the bully, it's, like, not good enough for them. They don't know what to deal with it. Like, they're troubled by it in some way.
You know what it is? They relate more to Trump than they do to the protesters. They've also backed down from every fucking fight they've ever had in their lives. So they see a little bit of themselves there.
And the fact that the most annoying thing for me is the way that they coat that. Their discomfort for it by going, this is going to help Trump, you know. This is just going to help him. I mean, first of all, you don't know that. That might be true. I don't think, and if this election is in such a place, I don't think anybody can say for sure, one way or the other, how anything is going to play out with, you know, the people. So that's just, saying that with any kind of blithe confidence is just so dumb. And second of all, motherfucker, you're not the one who he is telling is not really an American. You're not the one who's telling his bang asshat multitudes of supporters are somehow like some sort of subhuman species that needs to be eradicated. You know, and so people who are actually on the other end of that rhetoric have a right to assert their status in America how they see fit. And if that means going and actually, you know, speaking to these people and asserting themselves to them, then that's what they're going to do. And the idea that that you're going to sit there on the sidelines, somebody who's not implicated in any of this, and you're going to just be like, you know, that's not a good look.
Maybe it's illiberal of me, but I really don't give a shit that some dickhead dressed like Jesse Pinkman who was yelling whore and crackhead at random women, got his sign ripped in half.
No,
I really
fuck him. Fuck him. I don't care if that guy got fucking paralyzed.
And it is also, it's doubly precious on the right, though. Like, I'm really enjoying this. Like, the against Trump crowd of people who genuinely thought that Marco Rubio, like, pantsed Trump in that debate when they were like, oh, finally, you know, the emperor has been revealed without clothes. For an hour and a half, Marco Rubio masterfully took him apart, landing counterpunch after counterpunch and revealing the bully for who everyone thought was the alpha male but was really just a scared boy. And, they genuinely thought that. And I read almost that verbatim, like, the day after that debate where everyone tried to attack Trump. And it failed, totally. As any normal person watching that debate, any normal person, so that they barely laid a glove on him.
The conservative thing, I saw some fucking dipshit was arguing with me about this last night, and he said, well, the anti-Trump Republicans are already flocking to Trump, and it's like, they were going to do it anyway, because they tried to stop him for 8 months straight, and it didn't work because no one fucking likes them or cares what they have to say, and they have no influence on the base. And they were waiting for an opportunity to bend both knees and submit, and they finally got it. Like, this is what they were going to do fucking anyway.
Well, now this is their perfect excuse, because they can, exactly. Like, they can say, well, I hate Trump and he's bad, but these dark forces that are silencing our democracy, like, you know, cannot be tolerated. They're the real fascists. And now they have the perfect excuse for that. And you know, and the other thing, like, they've been begging for other people to, like, stand up to the bully, which is completely to their personality type, which is just people who have made careers out of demanding other people fight for them and die for them, really, in most cases.
Right. You know, for, you know, they if it's not people who got their brains fucked up in Iraq and now support Trump because they're sick of fighting these people's fucking wars and they feel like they've been used by these fucking just scum of the earth.
Jackals. These fucking...
Like John Thor. They want help. They're inbred syphilitic aristocrats.
I think
when it comes down to it, they'll end up backing Trump anyway, and this is or at least, like, go through the motions of doing it so that they can maintain some sort of idea that they still control the party, you know?
Right.
I don't think they're gonna. I don't think anybody in that party has, because people are talking about stealing it from them at the convention. I don't think any of them are smart enough or coordinated enough to do that at this point. I mean, they couldn't even decide on one candidate or one strategy during these months and months.
They had months to do it. They had months to do it.
Yeah. So I don't think the idea that at the last minute they're going to be able to cobble together some amazing Aaron Sorkin-esque House of Cards power play at the convention. I don't think they've got it in it. So what they're going to do is they're going to accept that Trump's the nominee. They're going to, you know, maybe do it, maybe be a little unwilling about it, maybe be a little, you know, a little...
They'll close their eyes and think of the country. Close their eyes and think of Reagan.
But they'll definitely point to stuff like what happened in Chicago as justification for them doing it. But they would have done it anyway, exactly. They would have found some pretext. Somebody would have said a rude word somewhere, you know. Killer Michael would have released some sort of rap that had some swears in it, and they would have been like, well, I can't. I mean, I don't like Trump, but we have to stand against this.
Right, no, they'll always find something that scares them more. I mean,
in this case, you know, black and brown kid, like, you know, teenagers and 20-year-olds.
Right, the shit that scares them more than anything in the fucking world.
Yeah. Anyway.
I don't know, but I'm still looking forward to Damon Linker's column.
On Monday.
Very excited.
We're all going to gather around. I want a montage, a Spielberg-esque montage of people around the country sitting down to read the Damon Linker piece to their families aloud in churches and barber shops and diners and people's living rooms, and then all of them coming together to realize the wisdom of his words, and then Trump being banished from the nation as a result.
Yeah, these Trump supporters, these Bernie supporters, they're going to look at each other and then be like, look, Damon Linker may look like an infant. His eyes, in fact, may look like two pussies. He may be weak. He may be a bad writer. He may have been writing for 40 years and still no one knows who the fuck he is. But this guy speaks to me. I'm not mad anymore. And I'm not afraid to admit that I'm not mad anymore.
I just want to say I disassociate myself from these ad hom attacks. I like Damon Linker and I respect him a great deal. Okay, here's a question for you guys. We mentioned earlier that Trump is easily going to win Florida. It's going to be Marco Rubio can't possibly stay in the race after that.
No.
Now, am I wrong? Marco Rubio also cannot. He's vacated his Senate seat, or he can't just go back to the Senate, right?
No, he's done in the Senate after next year.
He's done in the Senate after next year, right?
Yeah.
So what is Marco Rubio's post political career going to look like? On Street Fight, Felix, you said he was going to go away and come back and be like, I chive now, which I thought was a really good prediction.
Yeah, that is. I'm standing by that one.
Okay, is Rubio's going to become a chiver? I mean, yes. Yeah. What's his post political career going to look like?
Well, apparently he's super broke. Like, he's just got an insane amount of debt. I think I saw that a few times in the New York Times and stuff.
He can sell his boat, right?
He could sell his boat, but I think what he's probably going to do is he's probably going to move to a lobbying shop and get a seven figures a year to have lunch with, like, Representative Hork Dorkel from Idaho to make sure that there's enough, you know, child slavery
subsidies.
Enough potato subsidies and child slavery allowances in the Marianas Islands, that kind of thing. And so he'll rack up like 2 years of, you know, solid $10-20 million year contracts, and then probably maybe run for governor or something after Rick Scott goes back to the Everglades to.
When Rick Scott goes back to his coffin.
Yeah. I think he's going to be a lobbyist because he needs money. That's what I think.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe he could just like I was just thinking like he could just you know. Like open like a charter sport fishing thing in somewhere in the Keys or something, and just kind of like be like live that kind of Jimmy Buffett lifestyle.
You know what I legitimately see for him? He's gonna take the Bob Barr route, where like he was just not gonna hear shit from him for 10 years, and then he's gonna come back and be like, "Well, I was wrong about some things," and we're supposed to congratulate him because he used to be a piece of shit, and now he's slightly contrite about it. Marco is like just that. He's that type of empty piece of shit that would do that. He's just empty as fuck. He's gonna wear cool glasses like Bob Barr. He'll probably have gotten hair plugs by then.
Well, will he grow a beard though?
Yes.
He's definitely He's gonna grow like a sort of a wispy, like not sort of very full facial hair, but he's gonna have some kind of like hint of facial hair. He's gonna wear shorts for a couple of years, get some money, and then I think he's gonna make his big comeback.
Mm-hmm.
I say this because someone was teasing Ross Douthat, who said last year, quote, all of these pundits are going to look silly when Marco Rubio wins every Republican primary.
one of my favorite tweets of all time.
People were sending him that quote over and over again. And his buddy, fellow Reformocon, Rehan Salam.
MC Rehan Salam, thank you very much.
Yes, MC Rehan. He chimed in with just simply saying, he will be back.
But I think if he is, it'll be in some. It'll be like Bob Barr, like in a sad, like.
He'll be
like
interviewed by Ali G.
Yeah, I mean, he'll be like, yeah, he'll decide to be a libertarian or something. I mean, he's not going to be in national politics again, I don't think, in the near future. Because who is craving Marco? You know? Nobody wants Marco, basically. I mean, nobody wants somebody who looks at all times like he really has to go to the bathroom, and he's holding it.
I love the conservative line for like 8 years. It was like, we need someone who's going to stare down Putin. And so the guy that the establishment guys went to was Marco, a guy who looks like he's on the verge of fucking tears every time something does go wrong.
I could imagine, like, he meets Putin for the first time, and Putin just does, like, the... the boo thing to get him to flinch, and he just immediately pisses himself.
It's like one of those My Buddy dolls.
Oh my god, he looks just like that.
Okay, slight digression. Did you guys ever hear the story about Putin taking Bob Kraft's Super Bowl ring?
Yes.
You guys know this? It's amazing.
That's a baller move. I respect it.
This is why we. I hate the New England Patriots. So this is why I love Vladimir Putin. Bob Kraft was in Russia and met Putin and was wearing his like giant gaudy Super Bowl ring with like 3 pounds of diamonds in it or something like that, and did the mistake of bragging about it or saying like, you know, oh, like look at this or whatever, like this is my Super Bowl ring. And apparently, like, you know, in Russian culture, if you compliment someone, like if you compliment something of someone's, what you're really saying is that you want it. And so it's considered gauche to compliment something. And like, so, like, basically, Bob Kraft was tricked into giving Vladimir Putin, like, Vladimir Putin pulled the ultimate power move and just said, can I try on your ring? And then didn't give it back.
That's awesome, because, like, what the fuck is Bob Kraft going to do?
Yeah, what's he going to do?
Your sponsorship on my part for the Nantucket Golf Club, consider that going down the drain, Vladimir. Not going to do shit. He's got those FSB shooters with him. Kadyrov is going to light you up on the 50-yard line.
If I were Tom Brady, I'd be very careful about what I drank after that.
Yeah. I mean, my God, Putin's what? He's murking people in Washington, D.C. hotels now? I think he could take out basically everybody in the NFL if he wanted to.
Who did Putin kill in D.C.?
Well, I don't know if it was him, but his former press secretary and the co-founder of RT was in a hotel in D.C.
So the former founder of RT was beaten to death in a hotel room last week?
Yeah, pretty hardcore.
There's no way that's just like an accident.
No.
How many people get beaten to death in hotel rooms? Seriously.
Depends. Which kind of hotel rooms you're talking about?
Yeah,
Howard Johnson's. It's a little higher, I think, in Howard Johnson's than like Holiday Inn.
Probably, but like not a nice Washington D.C. hotel room, unless it was some sort of like they didn't like the amyl coated orange in their mouth got caught and they couldn't use their safe word.
That could have been it. You know, yeah. It could have just been a kink gone wrong. That certainly wouldn't have been the first time that happened in a D.C. hotel room, I don't think.
Do you think kink shaming will become part of the campaign? Do you think Bernie could be kink shamed in some way before the Ohio or Illinois primaries? Or do you think
Bernie is a pay pig?
Bernie, he's been married twice, you know. What ended his first marriage? I'm just saying, it's a question that one could pose. I'm not saying I am posing it, but one could pose it if my name was Jamil Smith or Jonathan Capehart.
Or, yeah, really any of those people.
I think if there's any kink that's going to shame Bernie, it's going to be the fact that he still owns slaves. Which I think is fucked up. I'm not going to lie.
I think that Bernie, like, you're going to see a lot of his problems with minority voters, like, in Louisiana. You see he lost Louisiana big when he said that he agreed with the events of Hurricane Katrina. Out of touch.
He said he agreed with the events of Hurricane Katrina because, you know, it affected rich and poor alike, and it, you know, it sort of united people across class lines.
That's true, yeah. It did start a national conversation about levies.
Are there any more national conversations that are left to start? What's gonna be the October surprise this year?
Huh. It depends on who's running.
Let's game this out. Assuming it's Hillary and Trump, you know, what's going to be the October surprise? Russian invasion of Turkey? That would be big.
In the car, Al Baghdadi comes out and endorses the story.
The big one that that the Kurt Schlichters of the world are sort of counting on is some sort of terror attack.
I think
that's pretty much inevitable. Yeah.
That's always a wild card. Speaking of Russia and Turkey, did you guys see the thing about Assad and Erdogan's wife beefing with each other?
Yeah, apparently it started the Syrian civil war.
Yeah, no, this is real. This was in the Financial Times, but it said, I'm reading from it, it says, high-level gossip in Ankara has said there is a personal element to the recent Erdogan's desire to overthrow the regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Back in the days when Syria and Turkey had close relations, the Assads went on holiday with the Erdogans. It is said that afterwards, Mr. Assad's wife, Asma, sent an email to her husband pleading never to be asked to do that again. This was a couple with no languages, she alleged to have said. He is a thug who has read only one book, and she is a frump interested only in shopping. The email came to the attention of the Turkish intelligence, and the rest is history. So again, be careful with those emails, folks. Be careful what you say in Slack. It may start a war 10 years down the line.
You think that's the thing with Assadis, like that Erdogan's wife is Kim Kardashian and Asma al-Assad is Ayesha Curry? You'll get you a woman.
Get you a woman who can do both.
The Rose of the Desert.
You know, people might assume that the book that she's claiming is the only one that Erdogan read is the Quran, but she's actually referring to The Purpose-Driven Life by Rick Warren.
No, it was The Art of the Deal by Donald Trump.
Erdogan he's like that street savage. He doesn't have time for books.
Yeah, he's not some damn eye doctor nerd.
Dude, he was out there doing fucking bids. He was doing bids in prison when Bashir was completing his ophthalmology residency.
I mean, Bashir's a rich kid, right? He's the scion.
Exactly.
Erdogan's up from the streets.
Like, I really think that Erdogan is the most intersectional leader in the world.
And you know what? Asma can, you know, say his wife is a frump who only cares about shopping. But, you know, if you came up with nothing, then getting that Gucci bag and those red bottom Louboutins is all the more important. It means a lot more. So I don't think we should shame her for being crass and materialistic.
I mean,
when you grew up with holes in your top or toes, you celebrate the minute you be having dough.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep, that's right. But, you know, all jokes aside, we are a pro Erdogan podcast.
Absolutely.
We are
Justice
sponsored.
And Development Party forever.
Yeah. Arrest, you know, we don't even really care who wins the U.S. presidential election. As long as they agree to extradite Gulen the traitor.
Yeah, may he burn in 1,000 hells. I am very excited to announce that I'm in collaboration with Arthur Chu to create a AKP branch in the United States. We're going to call it the Social Justice and Development Party. And the main plank of our platform will be extending Turkey's repression of trolls and haters from the internet.
The Kurds are a trollish people. They're such a trollish people.
Because if you insult Erdogan in Turkey, you can go to jail. And I think that that's the least that we should do to people who tell Arthur Chu that he looks like a sweaty toad.
Erdogan goes, they've said horrible things about me. They've accused me of being Armenian. Arthur Chu says, first of all, what the fuck? Second of all, are you okay?
Okay, is there some way we can get Milo Yiannopoulos within the borders of Turkey and have him insult Erdogan on Twitter?
Oh God, ooh. We can get Midnight. Midnight Express too. It'd be amazing.
I mean, taking away the check mark is only the beginning.
I think it's kind of alpha that he asked the White House about his check mark. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's a total baller move.
This fucking power move right there.
No, a lot of people were hating him on him for that. Like, you know, what the fuck? Like, why? You know, you have an opportunity to ask the White House press secretary anything, and you bring up your fucking Twitter check mark. But no, I totally agree with you guys. I thought it was awesome. I give Milo a lot of props for that because it was just so stupid and hilarious. But
how dare you, sir? Do you know that Jeff Gannon used to report here?
I bet Milo and Jeff Gannon know each other. I bet they're quite close. That was not homophobic.
Sir, Britt Hume was sitting in that chair when he asked George H.W. Bush what his favorite color was. How dare you?
What was the thing Jeff Gannon asked? Jeff Gannon in the Bush White House, he would ask questions like,
why are you so awesome, basically?
It's like, you know, some people in the press corps are rooting for the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade to win. Your comment, sir?
Yeah, that was basically it. Yeah, I was like, President Bush, how do you put up with the haters and trolls? That kind of thing.
That's a good question.
What is Jeff Gannon doing right now?
Oh, he's on Grindr, I'm sure. he's probably, I don't know. I mean, he was a rent boy, right? I mean, he was an actual prostitute.
Yeah,
if I remember correctly. I'm assuming he's back to that, right?
There's always employment there, especially in Washington, D.C.
Absolutely. He puts on a George W. Like RNC guys pay him to put on a George W. Bush mask and wear the flight suit.
And spit on them.
Yeah.
So hopefully in the future, I mean, this is obviously our pilot episode. This is a soft launch, and none of us really know what we're doing. But
it's a soft, by the way, launch.
Soft, by the way, launch. hopefully in the future, I'm hoping to get an audio mixer. We can get a real microphone so it doesn't sound like I'm, you know, broadcasting from an airplane bathroom or something. But I do want to find a way that we can, like, work in audio outside us just talking and have us, like, sort of respond to it, because I really would – my dream is that, like, so we can play on the show and talk about it. Dan Quinn YouTubes, Amiri King Facebook videos, and, like, just now when we were talking about Arthur Chu, I would love to play – that video of him playing with the Rubik's Cube where he says his parents were told that he would be either a genius or a serial killer. Because, like, we just need to get, like, other audio sources. I want to get a soundboard with a reggaeton, air horn, gunshots, and a toilet flushing sound. Like, spare no expense. I mean, like, it's going to get better, folks.
It's like a morning zoo crew, but woke.
Yeah. This is the woke zoo crew. I guess we didn't even mention this, but I am calling episode one the Chapo Trap House. This is episode one of Chapo's Trap House. But I'm not even wed to that name. This is a very loose format we're going with here, so the name may change. The guests may change. But what's not going to change is just awesome, incredible content.
The heat of the takes will always be piping hot.
They'll only get hotter. It's going to get better and better.
That's right. Chapo's Trap House. Pablo's Best Friend. The First Edition. Chapter 1.
Chapter 1. Digiscale and Vacuum Seals. Omuerta. The Code. Live by. Live by it. Live it. Love it.
Peace.
Signing off, folks. Till next time.